Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer, engineer, and plugin developer Joey Sturgis. But first, let's look at the news from last week. First of all, Amazon launched their new YouTube competitor, and it's called Amazon Video Direct. That kind of caught everyone by surprise, because although everyone kind of expects Amazon to jump into the music game, no one really expected them to jump in the video distribution game, especially user-generated videos, which is what this is. Now, what's interesting is that they already started with a pay structure. So if you upload to Amazon Video Direct, you'll be able to get paid on multiple levels, and they're paying a pretty reasonable rate, which I'll get to in a second. And also, they give you the ability to take down any videos that are infringing on your copyright. So they're way ahead of Facebook right away, which is a good thing. So here's how it works. You have four options when you upload your content. You can upload them to Prime Video. And the thing about Prime Video is there's about 90 million or maybe more subscribers. We're not sure, and Amazon isn't saying, but they already pay, I think it's $99 a year for Prime. So now you get a little piece of that as well. The second thing you can do is make your content available as an add-on subscription. So for most musicians, it's probably not a useful thing. If you have a television series, for instance, this could be useful. If maybe you're Beyonce, and you're going to be doing a series of videos every month or something, then maybe this could be useful. But nonetheless, it is an option, and it is available to you right away. The third one is you can offer your content as a one-time rental or a one-time purchase. So people could actually buy it or they can rent it. And of course, when they do, you get paid for that, which is very cool. And the fourth thing is you can make it available to all Amazon customers. This is ad-supported, so their ads are going to play, and you're going to get a piece of it. How much? Well, exactly the same amount as YouTube pays, which is 55% of the revenue that comes in. That being said, Amazon Video Direct does have a pretty interesting payout structure. So, for instance, it will pay video owners 15 cents per hour as a royalty fee in the United States, and about 6 cents per hour outside of the U.S. So in other words, for every hour of viewing that occurs, you're going to get paid 15 cents. And as you know, this is far more than YouTube is paying, and far more, way, way far more than Facebook, which isn't paying anything right now. Here's the downside. This is capped at $75,000 a year. Now, if you have 10 videos that are doing $75,000 each, you're doing pretty well. That's probably not going to be the case, and you're probably not going to bump up against this. But nonetheless, if you have a runaway viral hit, then the $75,000 a year cap is going to come into play. That said, there's not nearly as many Amazon Video Direct viewers, and there probably won't be anything even close to what YouTube has. So this is probably a moot point. The other thing that will happen is, again, there's a tier where people will either rent your content or they'll buy it. And if that's the case, Amazon is going to split that with you 50-50, which is pretty cool. That's pretty reasonable. They also go one more step. So what Amazon is going to do is it's going to distribute $1 million a month to the 100 most popular programs that are viewed by Prime members. So if one of your videos is one of the top 100 every month, you're going to get an extra bonus. You're going to get part of that $1 million. That's pretty cool. So Amazon Video Direct, look for that. It's going to be a reasonable alternative. It's not going to take the place of YouTube or Facebook Video, but nonetheless, it'll be a reasonable alternative anyway, because let's face it, there's a lot of people that go to Amazon every day, and there's a lot of people on Amazon Prime. So just look at it as a pretty interesting resource for the future. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my brand new Brand Your Music Crash Course, as well as my 101 Mixing Tricks course and other online video courses. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Another thing I want to talk about this week is something that I posted on my blog. It's an excerpt from the Recording Engineer's Handbook, and it's what I call the when all else fails checklist. So we've all been there where you're trying to get something to sound good, and no matter what you do, it just isn't working, and it's making you crazy. Well, okay, if you bump up against that, here's a checklist that may help you. So the very first thing is to change the source, if you can. And what that means is you change the instrument. So if, for instance, you can't get a guitar sound, we'd say, let's change from a Strat to a Tele, or let's change to a Les Paul, or let's just change the amplifier. That's the very first thing. Change something at the source, because sometimes you find that that makes all the difference. Okay, if that doesn't work, what's the next thing? Change the mic placement. So that mic placement that's worked for you every time, you might have bumped up against the time where it just isn't working. So now's the time to experiment. Try some other things, move that mic around, and you might be surprised. Just moving it an inch or two sometimes can make all the difference. Okay, if that doesn't work, the next thing to do is to change the placement in the room that you're recording. So in other words, wherever you're recording, just move to a different place in the room. Usually we like to do overdubs in the biggest part of the room, so we'll move everything into the center, but sometimes that's just not the right sound. It's not appropriate. So you might want to move towards a wall. And even move towards a corner, which we generally stay away from because of the bass loading, and we get too much low end. But in this case, it might be just a thing that you're missing. So change the placement of the instrument or vocal in the room. Next thing is to change the mic. And this is something I do a lot. If I can't get the sound, I'll change the mic right away, and I'm not afraid to change to microphones that aren't popular, microphones that aren't the most expensive. You'd be surprised sometimes. The thing that you least expect to sound good works perfectly. So change the microphone. The next thing is change the mic preamp. Sometimes it's the combination of mic and preamp and instrument that makes the whole sound, and you'd be surprised changing to a different mic preamp. And again, sometimes it's not even the most expensive one, it's just a different one, and suddenly you get that magic quality. It just works for the track. Another thing is change the amount of compression or limiting that you're using. Sometimes you're clamping down too hard and you need just a little less, or maybe none at all, or maybe you need more compression while you're recording. Or you'll decide, okay, I'm not going to use it while I'm recording, but I'm going to put it on while I'm monitoring to see what it's like. And then you can tell. Whatever the case, sometimes that makes a big difference. Another thing is to change the environment. Change the room that you're in. Sometimes the room just isn't right. Change to an ISO booth. Change to a different part of the studio. Change to a bathroom. Just change the environment, because sometimes there's your magic. And yet another thing you can do is maybe one of the toughest things, which is to change the player. Sometimes the player just isn't right for the part. Now, if you're with the band and maybe it's the songwriter who came up with the part, that's going to be a little dicey diplomacy-wise. But nonetheless, sometimes that's the best thing for the track, to change to a different player. And finally, and this is one of my favorites, it's come back and try the part another day. You'd be surprised how coming in with fresh ears, with fresh sounds, with just a fresh mind, really makes a difference. And the thing that you slaved over for hours the day before will go in a flash, one or two takes, done. So don't be afraid to just say, we're going to come back tomorrow and do this, because a lot of times that's going to be your savior. That's going to be what makes that track, what makes the sound, what makes the player actually perform it to the level that you're looking for. So those are the things. Change the source if possible. Change the mic placement. Change the placement of the instrument or vocal in the room. Change the mic. Change the mic preamp. Change the amount of compression or limiting that you're using. Change the environment. Change the player. Or finally, come back and try it another day. My guest today is Joey Sturgis, who was a successful engineer and record producer before transitioning into developing some very cool plugins. Joey Sturgis Tones now features a variety of audio plugins at very reasonable prices. I spoke with Joey via Skype from his studio in Indiana. I want to start by saying I love Finality.
Oh, thanks.
That's awesome, and I love what it does on a kick drum, which,
yeah,
very unexpected, but very welcome effects. It's dynamite.
When we started designing it, you know, it kind of started with like working with like guitars and stuff like that, And then we sort of entered this whole process of testing it on drums, and that's where it all fell apart. And so we spent 3 or 4 months just trying to get it to work really well on drums, because I wanted a limiter that could go on kick drums, could go on drum buses, and really like hold things together without completely smashing the drums and destroying it all. So, and you can take it that far, but we designed it for drums. Not first, but second.
Yeah.
So,
wow, sounds great. Give me the Joey Sturgis story here. What's your background? How did you get to doing plugins? I know there's some backstory there, so.
Yeah, it's quite a long one, especially when if you go from the beginning to plugins, because at a certain point in my life, I thought I was just going to be a producer, but then that quickly changed. So I'll start at the beginning, though. So when I was in school, I'd always had sort of played music since I was like 9 years old. Well, a little before that, but I actually started playing music in front of people when I was 9 years old. My whole family is musical. My parents play, they sing, aunts and uncles play instruments and sing, grandparents, everybody is involved in music. However, I never really intended to make music a career. It was always just sort of a pastime. And that same thing held true for most of my family. I have one uncle who, he actually does this professionally in Nashville, but, I never looked up to him as like, oh, I want to be like my uncle. I just sort of like in our family, music was just like a thing that people did, for fun. And my parents would do it occasionally on the weekends, to make extra money. So I had always played music, and it was funny because in my town, I was like a really good drummer, but I was only like 9 years old. And so I was playing drums for people in bands that were like average age of like 23. And it was really extraordinary. So there's actually some pictures of me somewhere where like my feet barely reached the kick drum pedal and I'm playing in front of like 2,000 people with a bunch of 20-year-olds.
Wow.
Long story short, I missed my first 2 days of high school because I was recording an album in Nashville.
I love it.
Yeah. So it's always been in the blood. And the moment where it really switched over to the whole production thing is around high school, around the end of high school, I was a drummer in a band and we needed to record a demo. And at that time, there really wasn't like a home recording revolution. You had to go to a studio, and studios were like $1,000 a day, and like nobody had that money. So my friend had some makeshift gear like set up in his garage that he kind of remodeled into a sort of like a building, kind of like a studio, but I don't want to call it that. And he gave me a key and let me go in there at night to just kind of mess around. And so I did that for a while until I got comfortable with the tools and was able to at least record something basic. And so what we ended up doing is we recorded the best of our ability, our demo, and put it on MySpace. That was back when MySpace was popular. And it just took off. Like, we got private messages from all around the surrounding cities of people saying, where did you guys record? How did you do it? You know, we want to do it too. And so I talked to my friend. I said, hey, would you be comfortable with me having like strangers coming here and recording for money? And I'll give you like a percentage of it. And he was like, yes. So that's how it all started. And I did that for a good while, recorded quite a lot of bands and got to the point where I ran into a band that just at that time, they were just doing something so radically different than everyone else. And I felt like compelled to be a part of it. And it was at a show when I actually met them. And so I came up to them. I was like, hey, you guys, I love what you're doing. Like, it's so crazy. I've never heard anything like this. Can I record you? And I was shocked because they said no. And it was like the first time that anyone had kind of said no to me like that before. And I had like stuff with me. I was like, here's what my stuff sounds like, you know, and they liked it, but they still said no. And it shocked me. And I came to find out that they were trying to basically learn how to do it themselves too, like I had done when I first started. And so I talked to them for a good 3 to 6 months or so. Okay, it's kind of hazy. I don't remember the exact amount of time, but I stayed in touch with them as long as I could and just kept continuing to basically show that I would be valuable to them because I was an outside ear. I was a musical person. I knew what they were trying to go for. I wasn't really trying to oversell myself, but I was just definitely pushing for it. And finally, they took me up on the offer. And that band ended up being the first band that I worked with that got signed. And so we had built such a great relationship over the time period that they didn't know where else to go. They had to make the decision, where do we make our record? And so they came back to me, and that's how I got my first record on a label. From there I did a couple of records, and some of the bands in that area were starting to get signed too.
What area?
This is in the Dayton, Ohio area.
Okay.
And I was located in Connersville, Indiana, which was like about an hour away. And these people were driving over to work with me. And the label was taking notice of my skill. And so the label reached out to me and was basically, the guy who owns it was like, hey, I think you're onto something. I like it. I want to be a part of it. Can I be your manager? And that was really off-putting to me at first. I was very anti-manager. I felt like anybody proposing, like, and you know, granted I wasn't as educated as I am now, but I felt like anyone proposing that is like trying to get a piece of something that I felt was mine.
Yeah.
And so it was really hard for me to like be convinced that it would be worth my time. But what I ended up doing is I came up with a list. I made a list of 10 things. I was like, I want all 10 of these things to happen and you can be my manager. I gave this list to him and he was like, okay, let's do it. And he made everything on that list happen. And really, that's when everything took off. Like, that's when I became known in the community, known in the industry, and I was doing, you know, records for labels on a regular basis. And so that was around the age of, I'd say, 23, 24, something like that. And now I'm 31. And I guess you could fast forward a little bit, all those years of producing, and go to the part now where I basically decided that producing was kind of boring. I mean, I'm good at it and it's not so much of a challenge anymore. I think the challenging parts of it aren't the parts that are creative. It's all the labels that you have to deal with, the red tape, and sort of the industry and dealing with like rock stars and all that kind of stuff. That's the stuff that start to become uninteresting to me. I didn't like that. So I naturally had to find something else to do with my time, and it became plugins. And I actually found it very liberating to be able to design my own tools. You know, imagine being able to build, like, you know, when you build a house, you pick up a hammer and a nail and some screwdrivers and stuff. But imagine being able to like design your own tools that can build houses. And that was very fascinating to me. And so,
how did you learn how to program?
I guess I skipped over that part. So in high school, I was pretty nerdy. And what I liked to do was come home from school and read on the computer. I would get on the computer, go on the internet and read about things that I was interested in. And I always, when I was younger, I was into games. And so I always wanted to learn how to make my own game. And that's how I got into programming. And so I learned how to, I made some games and learned how to program through that, and learned the concepts that were necessary later in life to kind of figure out how to prototype my own plugins. And it's kind of like, in a way, it's just a combination of like electrical engineering and math. And logic. So if you combine those things together, you're kind of on the right path for making, you know, something in the digital world. And audio can be broken down into zeros and ones. I mean, everything on a computer is broken down into zeros and ones. So if you can figure out how to explain it all from that point of view and break it all the way down, then you can make something. And that's what I started doing. And I did it just because, you know, what I was mainly doing was my life started to become a little boring. So, and also a friend bet me, I should mention that as well. He's like, I bet you could make plugins. And I was like, nah, sounds like a lot of trouble and a lot of, you know, a big rabbit hole that I don't want to go down, but I did. I eventually went down and that's where it started.
The first plugin that you did was what, and how did you decide to do it? So in other words, there must have been something that kind of triggered that I need this and I don't see something like it on the market or something that doesn't suit me. So how did that come about?
Yeah. So when I started, I had no intention of like starting a company or even selling anything. I was just messing around with stuff. And just as you do, like, you know, as a scientist or as an engineer or something, you take what you're interested in, and you play around with it. So I thought like, I want to kind of make my own plugin just for fun. I wonder what I should start with. Oh, I know. I'll start with a compressor. And that was one of the things that I was kind of passionate about, is I had a very specific, like this thing that I like about vocal compression, right? I would, you know, listen to other people mix vocals and be like, you didn't get the compression right. I always just was very specific about that. And so that's kind of where I started. And it took me a while to even get results that I felt were even like worthy of anyone else listening to it. because, you know, this is all mathematics and stuff. And it's a little different if you're doing it in the analog realm, like if you're using like parts and connecting them all together to build a circuit. If you're doing it in the digital realm, it's math. And so your number can be a little off and it can just make wacky results, like just really weird and alien sounding stuff that doesn't make any sense. And so there was a lot of that I went through until I figured out, like, you know, where the ranges sort of down to make sense to sound accurate to what we like to hear on vocal compression. So once I even got to that point, it was a process. That was perfect. After I had got it to a point where it worked and it was over, I don't even know, a few months of time, I basically just decided I'm going to package this thing up into something. I'm going to put some graphics on it. And I've worked in Photoshop before, you know, making video games. And like, so I had like kind of all the little fundamental elements necessary to sort of put the whole thing together. And I knew a little bit about web design because I had made some websites in high school. And so just combined all that stuff together, throw it up online, and had a little community too that I had built over time. People who were just fans of my production. So I had my audience, I had my product, and I had my business. And it just kind of came out of nowhere. It wasn't a plan at all. And then I put it out and it exploded.
Which one was
this?
I
am now. So I'm just riding the wave of that. We're doing very well. It's our, which company?
No, which product? You said it exploded.
The first one. Yeah. It's a gain reduction.
Oh, got it. Okay. Right.
So yeah, that takes us to now. And, somewhere along the line there, I kind of found my purpose, which I wasn't fully aware of before, which I feel is to help people make great music. And I'm doing it a lot of different ways. I do it as a producer. I do it as a plugin designer. I also do it as an educator. And so recently I've gotten into the whole audio education thing, and I started a company with some of my friends, and we've already launched one of our services, which is called Nail the Mix.
Saw that.
Yeah. So if you ever want to learn some stuff about that, it's nailthemix.com. We basically teach you how to mix, but we do it in a whole new way, in a way that no one's ever really done before. And very excited about that. And we have some more services on the way.
That's cool. Okay. I want to talk about that, but let's go back for a second. So you did your first plugin and it took off. How did you decide what to do after that? So again, it's one of those things where I'm always curious, and this is to all manufacturers and developers. It's like, okay, how do you decide what product to develop? Because a lot of times it could be one of two things. it could be market driven. It's like, I see a market niche and let's go there because there's a hole in the market. Or it could be, I really want to do this because I think I can do it better. So
right.
What was it?
It's more the latter. I found some holes that I didn't like. One, for example, is there was a plugin called G-Clip. It was only available for Windows. And I loved this plugin. It's a very simple, tiny little plugin that does digital clipping. And it's a good sounding.
It does digital clipping.
Yes, but it's a good sounding digital clipping. It's not the harshness kind that you're used to. It's made for being very, very aggressive to pushing your sounds to the absolute limit to kind of akin to how you would like overload a preamp or how you would like, you know, clip some converters or something like that. It has a pleasing result to it. And you can really push your drums to be extremely loud by doing this. This plugin was only available in Windows and I believe also only available as a VST. So then you couldn't even use it in Pro Tools, even if you had a Windows machine. And so I was set out to really just kind of solve that problem, but also improve the design because I didn't like how it was designed. I would use it, but I hated the design of it. So I designed, that was my second plugin, was to basically take that idea and run with it in my own way. And that was JST Clip. And I also increased the range. They had their range tied to 12 decibels. I tied mine to 24 because I wanted the ability to go double. So, yeah, that's how the second one came about.
And then after that, is it just because you have an idea or something you want to try or, you know, again, I'm really always curious how it comes about because it's different for different people, how they decide to do these things and how you develop a product. Cause you have a lot of products.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of them just come from, like you said, like I'll have an idea and I'll just kind of run with it. And then as you run with the idea, the very first version of your idea is never the best one, at least for me. Yeah. And so it sort of evolves into like a marketable thing. And you're like, oh, if we added this, then it would be a little bit more marketable. Or if we tweak this, like that makes it make more sense for other people other than just myself. And a lot of times I'm designing things for myself. But I would say that we're very in tune with what's going on and with what people are after and what they need and what they don't like about plugins. And I'm doing this in a way where I basically have my own communities online. I have thousands of people that I can reach through Facebook and through Twitter and Instagram and through email and all this. And we're paying attention to everything people say. We read every single message. We read every single comment. We even like we look at people who like our page and we go look at their page and say like, okay, what kind of guitars are they holding? What kind of plugins are they buying? What kind of questions are they asking? And just looking at all that stuff really just kind of tells us what to do. I think that might be what's missing for some of these bigger companies is that they don't have that sort of ear to the ground like we do. We literally live in it. Like it's something that happens every day. I'm on Facebook constantly just trying to stay in tune and up to date with what's going on. And a good example of this is when back in the early days, I remember so many people complaining about the fact that plugins didn't have mix knobs.
Yeah.
And so I remembered that. And when I started designing plugins, I was like, okay, every plugin is going to have a mix knob if it makes sense. And that's one of our design things that we do because people just want that. And I never understood why manufacturers wouldn't do it. It's like, you could easily add a mix knob to this plugin. Why isn't there one? And so we started doing that.
Yeah. It's so much better, especially like for compressions because parallel compression, that's kind of like a standard. Everybody's doing it. And it takes you a long time to set up unless you have the mix knob. You have a mix knob and it's there immediately.
Yeah.
Really.
Why make it to where they have to add all these tracks and routing and all this?
Yeah.
You can just put the knob on there.
How long does it take you to do a plugin?
It's a great question. Depends on the complexity. Some plugins can be done in 1 month and other ones take like 6 months to a year. Finality took 6 months. Let me think of a plugin. I think Game Reduction took about 2 months. JST Clip took about 3 months. So yeah, they kind of vary. Sometimes also you'll implement the idea and then you'll use it and you'll realize that the idea sucks. And once you've done that, it's a very painful process of redesigning it to where it makes sense. And that's what Sub Destroyer was. The original idea for Sub Destroyer was that it was going to be able to make bass drops in a bunch of different ways. But then the problem became, well, how do you decide which way the user is going to be able to use at any given time? So the original design was like, you can only use one way. But then the plugin became really confusing because you could switch your view so that you're looking at like the information for the MIDI, but you're using the automation mode. And so the MIDI is disabled, but you can still look at it. And that became really confusing. So we decided to just let all the modes work all the time. And that ended up being better. And yeah, as a user, you could go in and automate a sub drop, but then also play a MIDI note at the same time. And that would sound really stupid, but at least we've left it up to the user to figure out how they want to use the plugin rather than limit it to only be one way. So that's an example of how the reiterative design process can kick in.
I noticed that your prices are very reasonable and that you also don't offer demo versions. How did you come up with your pricing and just the idea of not doing a demo? Because that kind of flies in the face of the industry.
So I'll tell you, like, at first, the reason why we didn't have demos is honestly because we just didn't know how. Eventually, we figured out a way to make some demos, and we have a demo for Finality, but it really was just a limitation of our own knowledge. And then it kind of became a marketing strategy because now what we had to do was we had to build brand advocates, right? Mm-hmm. In order to sell things, because how are people going to buy things from us if they can't try it? So we basically just went off the fact that I had built a community of people who had trusted me and trusted my ear and my standards for quality. And so those things enabled us to really become successful without the demos. And it actually, the way that we looked at it was like, if there's a demo, then there's an excuse to not buy it. And I'll tell you the psychology behind that is that if I was like in the street, right, and I was like making some food in the street, I was like a street food truck, and I was like, okay, well, I guess that's a bad example. Let me think of something. Okay, like, basically, if you can try something before you buy it, you will every single time, right?
Yeah.
You're not gonna go there and just do an impulse purchase and not even give it a demo or give it a try. So we felt like that was like a negative thing. We didn't want that to be part of the buying experience. And so we worked very hard to make the plugin as tangible as possible. We wanted to show you what it sounded like, what it looked like, how it is used. And we did this with video. And we put a lot of energy into video. That was like our big way of basically demoing the product to you. And the pricing model comes from the fact that people are always complaining about how expensive plugins are, right?
Yeah.
And it makes sense. But if you become a plugin designer, you'll quickly realize the reason why they charge so much money for it. And the reason is it's the security. The security is very costly. And I'm talking about like piracy protection and things like that. So our approach was, let's build loyal fans and brand advocates, people who would literally tell on someone else if they saw somebody even trying to give the plugin away for free. And let's remove all DRM. Let's not have any kind of security devices, because people want to be able to just, you know, go out and buy a new laptop and install their plugins and go. And anyone that's in this industry knows that the copy protection process that happens when you set up a new computer is the most painful thing that everyone goes through. And even on an ongoing basis, I have a business partner staying with me at my house right now. We're working on some content, and he turns his computer on and none of his licenses work. And we spent 2 days just trying to get all this stuff to work just so he could open a session and hit play. And that was the most frustrating experience. And I know a lot of people go through that. So we wanted to be low price because that's what our audience can afford. We wanted to not have any copy protection because we feel that people don't like it and it's a negative thing to make the customer have to go through that. And we don't have any employees. So, it doesn't take a lot of money to run the company because I wear a lot of hats and I do a lot of tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's kind of the approach to everything.
That's pretty cool. Again, it's one of those, when you look at it from a marketing standpoint, if you charged a lot, let's just say you charged double, but discounted it, 50%. There's that psychological point where people think, well, I'm getting a bargain and it's worth more than it is. But then there's the other way, which you've gone, which is, wow, this is very reasonable for what it is. He's not trying to rip me off and he's not trying to pull the wool over my eyes either.
Exactly.
So that's very effective too. It has been for you.
Yes, I can totally tell you that it has been. And in fact, we honestly made the demo for Finality as an experiment because we wanted to see, is there something we're missing out on?
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone else does it. And from what we found, it doesn't seem to be very effective. And I'm not like hating on my plugin either, because I feel like if you use it, you'll want to buy it.
Yeah.
But I also feel like there's some percentage of people who aren't extremely serious about audio production in a sense that they can use the demo and they can hear it and that's enough for them, right? Like maybe they're just interested in the plugin. They want to try it out. They try it out. They think it sounds good. It's cool, but it's not something that maybe they're going to spend their money on because they don't really know how having a new limiter is going to make them more money, right? Or something like that. I guess I still am not 100% convinced with the demo model.
Well, you and I both know that there's a lot of people that are just plugin collectors that will get as many plugins as they can and hardly use most of them. And what ends up happening a lot of times with the demo, I think, if you don't instantly hear something that's magnificent, you're probably not going to spring for it. And it's also a time limitation too. You get it, you don't hear it instantly, and then you also don't explore it either. Where if you put some money down on it, then you kind of obligate yourself to at least exploring it to find something that that works.
Yes, exactly. That's what I think we found to be true, and we know it. I guess I could say to a degree that we kind of know it to be true because as an experiment, we took the list of people who had downloaded the plugin and we sent them an email and said, you're going to get 50% off the plugin if you buy it tonight. And the conversion rate on that was like 40%. So it just took a little nudge.
Yeah. You know?
It wasn't like these people were going to jump out of their chairs and go throw money at buying the plugin. But if we said, hey, we know you tried the plugin, and if you like it, here's an offer. And a lot of people took that. So I know it's a good plugin, and that's not the problem. I think there's just a lot of other little psychological and logistical things that go along with having demos that make it complicated. And, up until this point, we have been extremely successful without any demos.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think we're going to continue to really just invest in doing the video thing and audio examples and just trying to explain what the product can do for you and how it can do it in as many ways as possible.
Tell me about Devastating Drums.
The product's not called Devastating Drums, but we're claiming that our drums are devastating drums.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. That makes more sense. Yeah, so Joey Sturgis drums, the way that came about, basically in my early days at my first house that I bought, I was recording drums in there. And the thing that was really interesting is that I was getting pretty great drum sounds, but it was completely like not a drum recording environment. I mean, we're talking carpeted floors, drywall, and like just a dining room in a house. And I was working on all these albums, and my results were really great. And it part of making the process for me easier to do these albums, I would always sample the drum kit, because it would be easier for me to like replace one tom hit or drag in an extra snare hit or two here and there, rather than go and retrack a part if we messed something up or we wanted to make a change.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was making my own, basically my own sample libraries for myself, because it was making it easier for me to go through the process of fixing things. And after I would finish an album, that stuff would just sit on my hard drive. And I was sitting there one day just looking at all the stuff I had done over the year. I was like, man, look at all this stuff that's just sitting on my hard drive that'll never be used ever again. I should probably do something with this. And that's when I created, and this is all before the plugins, by the way, I created a store online, and I put that stuff up there. Basically just uploaded the files into a protected, you know, thing, so that the only way you can get it is to pay for it. And people just started buying it. Like I said, I was lucky enough to start doing this producing thing and build a fan base along with the bands. And I did that in a bunch of different ways. And if I tell you the story now, it sounds like I was a genius, but I swear to you, back then I had no clue what I was doing. Like, for example, YouTube was coming up and becoming more popular around that time period. And so one thing that I thought would be really fun to do, and there was really no other intentions other than just having fun, was to just record studio update videos and put them on YouTube. And come to find out years later, that was really integral to building my persona and building my popularity with fans, because what would happen is the band would go on MySpace and say, hey, you can follow us and through our journey through this recording process on these videos. So here, check out this video. And then people would go to YouTube and watch the video, and they would learn, you know, who the singer is and learn who the producer is, which is me. And over time, this just became like, you know, this is my name became synonymous with all these bands as they grew and become bigger and as part of a bigger movement. And that really helped me to build an audience of people who were not only just interested in the band, but also interested in audio production. So I was taking that fraction of people who are into audio production and building an audience out of them. And I think the moment it really took off was when I was a part of this forum called the Ultimate Metal Forum. Mm-hmm. And there's a famous producer on there called Andy Sneap, and he's like the metal god.
Yeah.
Everybody was on his forum. He had the Andy Sneap forum in there. Everybody was on it. And over time, it kind of became this thing where everybody was asking Joey Sturgis questions. Like, how does Joey Sturgis get his guitar tone? How does Joey Sturgis mic his drums? How does he do this? How does he do that? And it became really annoying to the Andy Sneap people. And so we decided to create a Joey Sturgis forum so that there would be a place for people to do all that stuff. And so that's when I got my first forum, and it was like an official forum on a pretty big site. And then that's things kind of grew from there. Then we moved to Facebook, and then we started collecting more people there, and it just really took off. And so the only reason why I was able to like really be successful in these drum samples and these plugins and all this is just from building that audience, you know, from the age of 19 to now. And just really being persistent with it. And like I said, in the beginning, I had no clue what I was doing, but I'm so glad that it happened.
That's very cool. It just goes to show you how integral social media can be.
Absolutely.
And not only that, it's not only integral to your success, but if you didn't do it, you probably wouldn't be where you were today, where you are today. And in terms of you know, just your products and everything else, it's very cool that whether it happened organically or not, it's just a great example of how this all works.
Yeah. Yeah. And nowadays I'm like a marketing dork. Like I wake up in the morning and try to find like a new marketing article to read. And so now, I feel like I got a really good head start, and now that I'm becoming knowledgeable on the topic, I'm able to like utilize my knowledge and utilize my head start, in ways that would be really hard for people just starting out. Like, you know, if you're in your mid 20s and you're just now building an audience, you know, that's hard.
Yeah.
And I've got something to go on. And now I'm applying actual, education to it, and it's doing really well.
Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've learned in your journey, or maybe somebody imparted to you along the way?
Oh man, that's a great question. I guess one thing that, this might be obvious, it might not, but I think success always looks really easy, but it never is.
Yeah.
You know, it really kind of, from an outsider's perspective, you see somebody like flying or going up or climbing, and it's just like, oh man, that person, you know, they must just have it really easy, or they must just be really talented. But in reality, even if you do have it easy and you are really talented, it's still chaos. It's still a mess. It still takes a lot of patience and perseverance. Like, you just can't give up. You have to just keep trying. And the other thing that I like to say, I know you asked for one, but I want to give you one more, is especially if you're an entrepreneur or you're self-employed and you're working for yourself, there's something that really clicked for me in the last couple of years that has made everything so much easier, and that's finding my mission. And I talked about this a little bit earlier, but basically, if you can find your mission, and you can summarize it in one sentence, you can tell people what you do in one sentence, and it's not too specific and it's not too broad, you'll be able to do a lot with that. Like, one of the things I always ask myself every day, anything I'm doing, if I'm watching a video or I'm writing a post or I'm replying to a comment, I'm thinking to myself, does this go with my mission? Is this align with what I'm here to do on earth? Is this help with my purpose? And if it doesn't, I stop doing it immediately. And I turn to things that make my mission more interesting for me and more interesting to the people that benefit from my mission. So for me, it's to help people make great music. And I try to make sure that everything I'm doing is tied to that in some way and helping push that forward. And it's kind of like having multiple webs and ways to strengthen your core, like your core product or your core skill or your core offer or your core value, whatever it is, like, that is you. If you can come up with that mission, you tie everything into it, you're just going to make that thing so much more valuable. And I think if you can get into the mindset of thinking that way, it will make you successful.
That's brilliant, Joey. And I wish I would have learned that way earlier than I did myself. I learned it way too late in life. And you're lucky that you learned it when you did. And also express that to other people, because it's really true. After you've kind of figured that out, life gets a whole lot easier, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
The more I talk to you, the more interested I am, honestly, because, I mean, you're coming from the right place on this. You're coming from a place where you're a user yourself, and you're a discerning user, so you know specifically what you're listening for, as compared to just some engineers who are developers that are kind of blind. if you know what I mean.
I think that was also part of the reason why I really felt like running with this, is that I saw the uniqueness in starting a plugin company as a producer. I had seen other plugin companies go to producers and collaborate, but I had never seen a producer really start his own company in the way that we did. So that was also like a thing where it's like, you know what, I want to do this. I feel like it's the right fit and it's the right time, and I can do this. And that's where I kind of approached it from that angle as well.
To find out more about Joey and his plugins, go to joeysturgistones.com. That's Joey, J-O-E-Y, Sturgis, S-T-U-R-G-I-S, Tones, T-O-N-E-S, all one word, joeysturgistones.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyointercircle.com, or find it in iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyointercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.